This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Elton John, has a flair for the extravagant. But his new album, The Diving Board, is the opposite of flashy. The songs are reflective, and the music is stripped down to piano, bass, and drums, with some extra instruments on several tracks. As Alan Light wrote in Rolling Stone, the album returns to the kind of spare, country-flavored narrative songs with which he made his name on early 1970s masterworks, before he plugged in his electric boots, transformed into Captain Fantastic, and became the biggest rock star in the world. The songs in the new album were written with John's longtime lyricist Bernie Taupin. Their many hits include Rocket Man, Crocodile Rock, Honky Cat, Tiny Dancer, Benny and the Jets, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Your Song, and Candle in the Wind. Terry spoke with Elton John last Monday, and they began with the song from The Diving Board. This is Home Again.
The world had seven wonders once upon a time. It's sure enough the favored nations aided their decline. And all around me, I've seen times like it was back when. But like back then, I'd say amen if I could get back home again. If I could go back home, if I could go back home, if I never left, I'd never have known. Wind up in the end, spending all our time trying to get back home again.
Elton John, welcome to Fresh Air. What a great treat to have you on our show. Thank you so much for coming.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you.
This album has, a kind of different sound to it. You know, your voice is deeper. There's a sense in the songs of looking back, of reflecting on the past, both the historical past and the personal past. And I'm wondering if that mood and if that kind of lyrical cohesion was something that you and Bernie Taupin intended, or is it just the way it worked out?
I think it's just the way it worked out. I think the album has its mood and its sound because T-Bone Burnett, who produced the album, took me out to lunch, or we went to lunch, and we decided to talk about my solo album. I'd done a record with Leon Russell before with him called The Union. And T-Bone suggested that I go back to my original lineup live on stage, which was just piano, bass, and drums. And he said, you know, you became a success with piano, bass, and drums live, but you never recorded with piano, bass, and drums as a template. And I couldn't believe it because he was absolutely right. The sound that made me famous, I'd never made a record using that sound. And I think the fact that we went in with just three musicians, piano, bass, and drums, and put all the tracks down like that, made the sessions very relaxed. I had no idea what the lyrical content would be, and I never have done with Bernie. But I think at our age, I mean, I'm 66, he's 62, it's a reflection on where we are in our lives. It's a very adult album. It's a very sparse album compared to the albums I've made before. And I'm very relaxed. I'm very happy with my personal life. When I started the album, I had one son. When I finished the album, I had two sons. And I think subconsciously, all that played into the end sound and the end product. The relaxed mood of which I played and which I sang was just a joy, and I've never had that ever happen to me before when making a record.
T-Bone Burnett, as you mentioned, heard you when you first started performing in America. He heard you at the Troubadour, and those shows that you did there have become, you know, kind of famous in rock history. Tell us what you did there, and tell us a little bit about who you were then.
Well, the Elton John album was a very orchestral album. The cover of the album was very dark, you know, very dark with a picture of myself on it. And I think most people in America that had heard the album up to that point didn't know what to expect live on stage. They thought maybe I was going to be some shy, introverted piano player, singer who came on and was very Randy Newman-esque. Whereas we'd been playing for over a year in Britain, a year and a half, with the band, Nigel Olsen on drums and Dee Murray on bass. And we were far from that. I emerged on stage in hot pants and boots, like Doc Martin boots with wings on them. We were a rock outfit more than anything else. And then the songs from the Elton John album, like 60 Years On, were given a radical different treatment live on stage. So I think that played into my advantage. So because people didn't expect me to come on and be full pelt rock and roll, they thought it was going to be kind of a sedate evening of a nice new British singer-songwriter. And it wasn't the case at all. And I think, as it has happened a lot in my career, it's kismet, it's luck, it's just being in the right place in the right time. And it certainly was then. And the Robert Hilburn Review from the LA Times kind of took 2 years off my work schedule because it spread around the country like wildfire. And it meant that I didn't have to play second on the bill in LA or New York, but it made my name a household name in those kind of big cities. However, America is a large country, and I spent 2 years touring with other people, playing second on the bill and paying my dues, which I love because I was playing with people like Derek and the Dominoes and Leon Russell and really getting a lot of experience. And that's the best thing to do. I wasn't ready to headline big stadiums or big arenas because I just, come from playing to 500 or 600 people in England and playing to 200 people at the Troubadour, and then went straight into playing Anaheim Convention Center with Leon Russell, which was 5,000 or 6,000 people. So it was an incredible experience to happen so quickly.
So the clothing that you described wearing at the Troubadour, that so surprised people because they were expecting something more Randy Newman-esque. Could you have done that in your hometown? Did you have to leave to be able to dress that way on stage?
I was dressing that way in England anyway, just for the stage purposes.
Right.
I mean, we're all fashion conscious in those days, very much so. But for stage, there was a designer in London called Mr. Freedom who gave me all these clothes and said, go for it. And as a child, as a teenager, I was kind of not allowed to wear fashionable clothes, winkle picker shoes or chisel-toed shoes, and I always wanted to. I've often said I lived my teenage years in my 20s when I sort of left home and became Elton John's success. Then it became Elton John excess. If you get, everything I couldn't do when I was younger, I did in 10 times over. Hollywood Bowl, which was the biggest show that I'd done up to that point in my career, was very, very funny. When you look back at it, it's quite outrageous. I was introduced by Linda Lovelace. There was the Pope, the Queen coming down the stairs, and I came out in this big marabou outfit. But I was having the time of my life. I was becoming the person that I wanted to be, and no holds barred. It was very exciting and a lot of fun.
We are recording this on Thursday, September 19th, right before you perform at the Emmy Awards.
Right.
And our listeners will be hearing this after you've performed at the Emmy Awards. And you're doing a tribute to Liberace because the movie about him, Behind the Candelabra, is not nominated for like 15 Emmys. And who knows how many, if any, it will have won by the time this was broadcast. But anyways, he was, you could say, you'd look at Liberace and of course you'd think he was gay, but he wasn't publicly out, and I think it was an era when it was like it was okay to be gay as long as you didn't mention it, as long as
Liberace came to England, and there was a columnist in the Daily Mirror who said he was gay, a guy called Cassandra. Well, that was his pseudonym, and Liberace sued and won. He said, "I'm not gay," and he won the libel case. When I was young and I watched the Liberace show or any show that came from America that, was musical, it was pure magic. The Americans did things on a bigger scale. Liberace, because he played the piano, I was very much interested in. He was a good pianist, but he was not a great pianist. And I was enchanted by him, and I loved him. His dialogue with the audience was very, very funny, especially when he did live shows. And I did get to meet him. I did the Raw Variety Show with him in London at the London Palladium. And I planned my two big outfits, and I thought, well, Liberace, I've got to do something special. So I had two fabulous Lurex suits made in red, white, and blue. And they were hanging up, very proudly in the dressing room. And then Lee, who he liked to be called, Liberace, Lee walked in with trunk after trunk. He wore that outfit with the light bulbs in it. And, so my attempt to, go one up on Liberace, failed absolutely miserably, but he was so charming and so lovely, and very, very funny and very, very intelligent. And he was a huge influence on me. It's like he was being who he was. He wasn't publicly out, but he didn't give a flying monkeys about what he was wearing. He just went for it. And that was who he was. And that, of course, influenced me when I started wearing the clothes and, you know, it subconsciously must have, you know, if you're stuck at a piano and you're not a lead guitarist or a lead vocalist, you're kind of at a 9-foot plank and you have to do something about it. So my thing was to leap on the piano, do handstand and wear clothes that would attract attention to me, because that's the focus for 2.5 hours or 2 hours. I'm not walking around the stage. I'm not moving. So he gave me that idea, probably subconsciously, because before then I'd never seen anyone dressed like that.
You know, I was reading a 1973 Rolling Stone interview with you in which you said that your act is going to become a little more Liberace-ized. And I thought, wow, 1973, you were thinking about making your act more Liberace-ish.
Well, it was all my stuff has been done with firmly tongue in cheek. You know, I wasn't a heartthrob David Bowie or Mick Jagger or Rod Stewart in those days. I was, you know, I was Elton at the piano, and I just had to turn the attention onto something comedic or even more outrageous than it was. Of course, with those kind of things, as is my want in everything I do, I took it too far, and it, you know, became it. In the beginning, it was natural. I didn't think about it. It was like, oh, yeah, let's do this, let's do that. And then it became like, oh, what am I going to do next? And that's the dangerous sign. It's like you think about it too much. In the end, it became tired and it became too much. And it became less fun. And I think a lot of the critics, the costumes put people off me. They weren't listening to the music as more or less looking at what I was wearing. I was singing great songs, but I was also wearing, you know, a giant chicken outfit at the time and being helped on stage by Mr. Universe on his shoulders. So, you know, anything like that, it was all down to me. It was my fault. If anything, you know, if they didn't like what I was wearing, then I couldn't really do much about it.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Elton John. His hits include Rocket Man, Crocodile Rock, Honky Cat, Tiny Dancer, Benny and the Jets, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Your Song, and Candle in the Wind. Let's hear another track from his new album, The Diving Board. This is The New Fever Waltz.
Forgotten scars remind us of too much war, too little love. Beneath the fault line, truth to burn. Within the page, so much to learn. Wounded birds look to us. Who can heal? Who to trust? Bring down the giants, old and new. Strike up the band and waltz on through. I was shaking with a fever when the last good horse went down. We were just a couple dancing where a thousand kings were crowned. Shaking with a fever before the white flag flew, and the ballroom opened up to us, and the dancers danced on through.
You've described yourself as being shy when you were growing up, and you're certainly not shy on stage, not in how you dress, not in how you perform, not in anything. So what's the connection between the extravagance on stage and the extroversion on stage and the shyness that described you as a boy before you became a performer?
Well, initially, I mean, I think performers are all show-offs anyway, especially musicians. You have to, unless you show off, you're not going to get noticed. And you can stay there and just, you know, play and you won't get noticed. But for me, music is so passionate. I have to give it my all every time I go on stage. And that comes from seeing performers like Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and Fats Domino and Elvis Presley. Great performers gave great performances, and that's the way I've always thought. On stage, it was always comfortable for me because that's where I felt at home. Off stage, it was a different situation. I was still shy off stage. And unfortunately, my shyness and my inability to communicate and really have great conversations or be part of the gang, in inverted commas, led me to the drug addiction, which, you know, blighted my life for 16 years because I thought by doing that, it would make me join in. And I did. And, you know, cocaine made me talk forever. It, you know, the most nonsensical rubbish that you could ever think of. But it, for me, I thought, well, that's going to open me up. And it did. And it led to 16 years of drug abuse, which, you know, I put to rights in 1990. And I had no balance in my life, Terry. I was, you know, this one person on stage and this person off stage who really didn't know much about living. I'd progressed on stage as a performer, but I hadn't progressed as a human being. You know, fame makes you very self-absorbed. I was very, very famous all around the world because I was a global artist. I went all around the world. And that leads you into a little bubble, and it leads you to become very insular. I had people in Miami who were very controlling, so I didn't like confrontation, so I just delved into drug addiction and alcohol addiction. And until I got sober in 1990, I really hadn't grown up at all. So when I did get sober at that point, I had a lot of catching up to do with the personality on stage, but with the real person off stage, and to attain the balance in my life. I had to learn to walk again, basically. I had to learn how to function as a human being. And I really enjoyed that process. I mean, when people go to rehab and come out, they go through a difficult period, a lot of people. I never had that. I was so glad to be rid of all that crap. That for me, to learn again and to function as a human being and learn how to participate in the human race again was just pure joy. And in 1993, I met my partner, David. In 1993, I did The Lion King. So great things came my way. But I met someone who was willing to be in a relationship, but only if it was a 50-50 relationship. Before I had the relationship with David, I tended to take hostages because they had to fit in with what I did. Mm-hmm. And you take them around the world, you buy them a Versace shirt and a Cartier watch, and then within 6 months they hate your guts because they have no life. And I did that repeatedly, time and time again. I had to learn how to share, how to take part in a proper relationship. And since that, I've been 23 years now, clean and sober, and the most amazing things have happened to me. So it was just, the 90s were a great time. It was like I became alive again. I functioned, and it was terrific. And I haven't stopped since then, and I've never regretted getting sober. And I would never, even though I don't take it, lightly, I can tell you I won't have a drink again and I won't have a drug again because my life is so brilliant that, you know, I regret wasting those 16 years. But it was necessary to go through those 16 years to come out as the person I am now.
You seem to be the kind of person who, when you do something, you go all the way. So, like, with clothing, it's going to be, you know, extravagant. You're not going to have, like, one pair of great glasses. You're going to have, like, probably hundreds. And, you know, with drugs, and with songs, like you write so many songs and you do so many performances. And with drugs, it was probably hard for you to just do it part way. I mean, with that.
Of course it was. I mean, I can't have one tie. I can't have one car. I can't have one of anything. I'm just an addict in everything. And, you know, I had the appendicitis happen to me this year, which was 6 weeks of having a burst appendix and doing 24 flights, 9 shows and our summer ball.
I don't even understand how you survived that. A burst appendix.
I don't know
and
how
you're
either,
touring.
But I should actually be dead because if my body hadn't have been such a good had protection and had stopped me getting peritonitis, I would have been on a flight and I wouldn't be here. And so that was another sign. You know, as soon as that happened, David and I said, I don't have to work 12 months a year. I'm the sort of person, and you nailed it just now by saying, if I had done 100 shows last year, I want to do 120 this year. Why? I don't know. I'm afraid that's part of my Achilles heel is the way I think like that. I'm so kind of driven that you think, stop it. You know. And so David and I sat down after the appendix thing had happened. I said, you know, I don't have to work. I don't have to. I'm going to maybe work 6 months a year and take my kids to school. But the work became like the drug addiction, the clothes, anything in my life. It's become an addiction. I'm addicted to working.
You've been active for LGBT rights, and you've said you're going to perform in Russia because you want to be there for the gay and transgender audience, as opposed to not entertaining them and kind of punishing them further punishing them.
No.
Was that a difficult decision? Because I'm sure you knew it was going to be like a controversial decision. You kind of can't win in with that one.
Well, it is a conundrum. I mean, on one hand, I want to say I'm not going, and you know, you can go to hell, you guys. But that's not helping anybody who's gay or transgender over there. I've been going to Russia since I was in 1979. I've been going quite frequently, and I've always had a wonderful rapport with the Russian audiences and with the Russian people. And, you know, there are a lot of great Russian people out there who are outraged by what is going on. But they don't have, you know, I don't want to abandon them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll probably get criticized for going, and I can understand that. It's just I, as a gay man and a gay musician, cannot stay at home and not support these people who have been to lots of my concerts in the past. I'm aware of the situation, and I will be diplomatic. I'm not going to go into Russia and, you know, telling them to go to hell and things like that. That's not the way things are done. You chip away at something, and you hope that there will be dialogue and that the situation can get better. You don't just go in there with guns blazing and say, well, to hell with you, because they're going to say to hell with you and get out of the country. That's not going to solve anything. But if I can go there and maybe I can talk to some people in the administration. And
are you going to try to do that?
I hope so, yeah. I mean, there's no point in going otherwise. You can make a statement and you can read it from the stage, but it would be nice and it would be much more fulfilling to try and meet with people in Moscow and say, listen, this is just, you know, this is silly. It's a reactionary, knee-jerk thing. It's harming your reputation in the rest of the world. It's not doing you any good. There has to be some discussion here. It's what you're doing is outrageous. But I'm not going to, you know, they can tell me to go to hell. I've got to do it diplomatically, but I'm going to say what I think and what I feel.
Would you like to try to meet with Putin himself?
I would love to try and meet with Vladimir Putin, but, why would he want to meet with me?
Do you think maybe he's a fan of your music? Is that possible?
I don't know. I would doubt it. Who knows? But, I mean, I have met Medvedev before. He's come to one of my shows. You know, you must do things on a political basis. You know, I might get shot down in flames. I might not. Who knows? But if I don't do it, and I think I am the acceptable face of homosexuality as far as entertainers go in the world, and I've got to use that to my advantage and go there and say, listen, come on. I've been coming here since 1979. I adore Russia. Russia has always been so great to me. What is this all about? Can I help solve this situation? Can I help improve it? And that's what you do.
Well, Elton John, I'm so grateful you were on our show. Thank you so much for doing it.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it, too. And it occurs to me, should I have been calling you Sir Elton?
No. No one calls me sir. Thank you.
Okay. I feel better already.
No, don't worry about that, for God's sake.
Okay.
No, I get called much worse things than that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much and be well.
Well, thank you. And give my love to Philly, okay?
Will do.
Elton John spoke with Terry last Monday. His new album is called The Diving Board. You can watch a video for the song Home Again on our website, freshair.npr.org. The new Showtime series Masters of Sex tells the story of the relationship between Dr. William Masters and his partner Virginia Johnson, whose 1966 book Human Sexual Response became an international bestseller. The series is based on Thomas Mayer's book of the same title, and stars Michael Sheen as Masters and Lizzie Kaplan as Johnson. Our critic-at-large John Powers says the show reveals quite a lot about American culture today.
Way back in the 1950s, before people tweeted snapshots of their privates or posted their hookup diaries online, it was considered inappropriate to talk too much about sex. The guardians of culture treated it as something better kept in the dark. Two pioneers who helped bring sexuality into the light were Dr. William Masters and his colleague-turned-wife, Virginia Johnson, who became perhaps the 60s unlikeliest icons. Following in the footsteps of Alfred Kinsey, who shocked America with his reports on what people actually did in the bedroom, this odd couple's trailblazing research showed what was happening to people's bodies when they did it. Their partnership is the subject of a new Showtime series, Masters of Sex. The show begins quite badly. The pilot, in particular, is shockingly coarse. But if you can hold out, Masters of Sex begins to find a stride around episode 3. And watching this series, you get a sense of how far we've come, and haven't come, in the 47 years since Masters and Johnson published their book, Human Sexual Response. Beginning in 1957 St. Louis, the show stars Michael Sheen as the brilliant, perpetually bow-tied Masters, a bottled-up, tyrannical OBGYN who makes Bill O'Reilly seem as huggy as Jimmy Fallon. Married without passion to a warm but neglected wife, played by Caitlin Fitzgerald, Masters has an inner turmoil that clearly drives him to investigate sexual behavior. Looking for a secretary, he hires Johnson, a one-time singer wonderfully played by Lizzie Kaplan, our reigning queen of weird energy and acerbic effervescence. Twice divorced with two kids, Johnson is as untroubled by sex as Masters is uptight, even going to bed with his protege, Dr. Ethan Haas, that's Nicholas DeGosto, who gradually becomes this series' version of Mad Men's resentful Pete Campbell. For a control freak like Masters, Johnson's spontaneous ways are a torment and an enticement. Here she comes into his office to talk about his startling, profoundly unromantic proposal that they sleep together. As research, the meeting is disastrous.
Good morning. Coffee's hot. The American Obstetrics Dinner is Thursday. You're speaking last. I have your notes. Senator Ronson called twice this morning and said he will only speak to you. And also, I wouldn't mind a moment of your time. I've thought about your proposal. The two of us participating in the study together.
There is no study. I've just returned from Provost Scully's office. He informed me that someone told him that my sex study had progressed to copulation between couples, which incensed the provost to such a degree that he shut down my study as of this morning.
Well, who would ever...
I warned you about sleeping with Haas. I told you it was dangerous and unprofessional. I also warned you about discussing the study with him, yet you did both, knowing the risk involved.
Ethan would never...
You defied me!
Of course, Masters doesn't get rid of her. He needs her, in more ways than one. Soon, the two are packing up the vibrators and wiring up women at a nearby brothel. If this sounds funny, it also hints at what made Masters and Johnson so daring. They studied physical responses to sex in an era when millions of ordinary women didn't know that they'd never had an orgasm, and universities feared housing sexual research. Beau Bridges shines as the provost who tells Masters no. Now, with its selfish hero and spunky heroine working in a male-dominated world, Masters of Sex pretty clearly aspires to be the Mad Men of sex. Like that show, it bridges the 50s and 60s, letting us see a change in American values with a story about those helping to change them. And like Mad Men, it lets us feel superior to those who were so foolish as to be born into values less enlightened than we were born into. But Masters of Sex is missing Mad Men's ruthless clarity and sense of detail. Where Matthew Weiner wasn't shy about making Don and Betty Draper the nastiest married couple in TV history, this show's creator, Michelle Ashford, appears worried lest her show seem too serious, too grown up, too unlikable. Clumsily juggling tones, she interlaces genuinely powerful scenes, like Masters' ruthless showdown with the provost or Haas striking Johnson, with silliness and cliches. Nowhere is Masters of Sex worse than in its unmasterful vision of sex. Rather than treating it maturely, it exemplifies much of what remains retrograde about premium cable and American pop culture in general. The gratuitous nudity, the squirmingly unsexy lovemaking scenes, the reflexive jokiness, which reminds us that sex still makes people very, very nervous. At one point, the show actually cuts from a couple having sex in a car to a shot of a neon sign with a hot dog in a bun. Maybe such a gag will crack up the 12-year-old boys watching at home. But it's faintly depressing that half a century after Masters and Johnson helped liberate human sexuality, a TV show about their lives should so often reduce it to the ignorant sniggering from which they were trying to set us free.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. Coming up, journalist Jonah Engel talks about his new article in Mother Jones called Merchants of Meth. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Millions of Americans have been introduced to the fictional world of methamphetamine use and production through the AMC series Breaking Bad. Our next guest, journalist Jonah Engel, has spent a lot of time in the world of real-life meth users and makers. His article in the August issue of Mother Jones magazine focuses on the explosion in the number of meth addicts who cook their own drugs with ingredients available over-the-counter in drugstores and supermarkets. It's a process that's dangerous to cooks and corrosive to their communities. Many states have tried to pass legislation making it more difficult to buy cold and allergy medicines that contain a key ingredient in making meth, the decongestant pseudoephedrine. But only Oregon and Mississippi have passed laws that make pseudoephedrine a prescription drug. Engel tracks the highly funded efforts of lobbyists for the manufacturers of cold medicines that have opposed and largely thwarted the passage of these laws in other states. His article in Mother Jones, supported by the investigative fund at the Nation Institute, is called Merchants of Meth: How Big Pharma Keeps the Cooks in Business. Well, Jonah Engel, welcome to Fresh Air. You write about a 15-year-old girl in Kentucky named Amanda, whose parents got into this home-cooked meth. Tell us just a little bit about what she noticed about her mom and dad and what happened.
The first thing Amanda describes is coming home one day to find her mother passed out on the kitchen floor, completely unresponsive, to the point where Amanda actually thought her mother was dead. What had in fact happened was that her mother had crashed after being high on meth. And in my reporting, recovering meth addicts tell me that they would sometimes stay up for days, if not weeks at a time. And when they crash really hard and almost nothing can wake them up. And what was remarkable about Amanda's story was how fast it all happened. She described her family as a loving one, as close-knit. But in the winter of 2004-2005, her parents, although she didn't know it at the time, started using methamphetamine. And within 4 or 5 months, their lives had fallen apart. Her father lost his job. He had sores break out over his face. Her once, you know, overweight mother became gaunt. And it devastated the family.
And what did she do?
Well, she actually, her grandparents lived next door, so she spent most of her time with her grandparents. But she knew something was up. Her mother insisted nothing was wrong, and increasingly the trailer in which her parents and younger sister lived became increasingly chaotic. There was a really nasty smell, and at a certain point she just wasn't buying it. So she started sort of looking around online, and she started putting things together. She noticed empty canisters of Coleman fuel, battery packs, and she put those into Google, and she discovered that these are the ingredients for making meth. And she told her grandparents, and one day while coming home from school, she got off the bus to see police cars filling up the driveway. They kicked in the door, took her dad away. She didn't see him for 2.5 years. He was incarcerated in a federal penitentiary, and her mother was also incarcerated. So it had a terrible impact on the family. I'm happy to say that they've been reunited, and she says they're closer than ever. And I was able to witness that myself. So it has a happy ending. But this was 2005, and it's really when this new method of making meth starts hitting the scene, known as shake and bake.
To the extent you can do so responsibly, tell us how you cook meth in your home.
Well, it's remarkably easy to make meth this way. All that you need, and the one thing that you have to have, is pseudoephedrine, which is a decongestant that's easily obtained in cold and allergy medicines. You crush it up, and then you just add a handful of other chemicals. You shake it together, and then in a separate bottle, using some other over-the-counter products, you create a gas. And basically that crystallizes the solution you've made. So I mentioned things like Drano, lithium strips from batteries, Coleman fuel, and it's really put meth production in the hands of meth addicts. So while I said it's easy, it doesn't mean it's not without its tremendous risks.
And talk about some of those risks.
Well, if all goes well, that is to say if there's no fire or explosion, because we're talking about highly volatile chemical reactions contained in nothing but a pop bottle, if that doesn't blow up or catch fire, it still produces toxic gases and byproduct, which goes into the carpet, goes into the paint. People find meth labs in hotel rooms. They found one in a Walmart bathroom, in cars. So wherever these meth labs are found, you have these bad gases and byproduct. And so in a house, you know, where there are young kids, they crawl around the carpet and they're breathing this stuff in. And so from that stem a whole bunch of problems for law enforcement, for foster care services, for the whole community, in effect.
And to give us some context, I mean, this is a relatively recent phenomenon. How was meth made and distributed before this shake-and-bake method?
So meth, until the mid-2000s, was primarily a West Coast drug. You had Mexican drug trafficking organizations working with biker gangs on the West Coast. The main method was something called P2P, which uses a different precursor called phenyl-2-propanone. But the thing about P2P is that not anyone can do it. It requires some serious knowledge of chemistry, and it doesn't produce meth that's as potent as shake and bake. Shake and bake is the most potent meth available in the world.
Wow. So I guess what's interesting about this is, I mean, there are a lot of drugs and a lot of drugs that are sold and used, but most of them aren't made by the addicts themselves. What are the consequences of addicts being able to cook up their own drugs?
Well, as I mentioned, it's a highly risky process. Often you have meth cooks who haven't slept in days, so they shouldn't be operating a vehicle, let alone, you know, engaging in volatile chemical experiments. And we're seeing it play out. In Kentucky, I went to one of two burn units in the state. Burn victims from meth accidents have tripled in the past few years. Their injuries are usually much worse than the average burn victim. They've got both chemical and thermal burns. They're often abusing prescription painkillers, which makes their pain management much more complicated. None of them are insured. The other thing to add is that shake and bake is concentrated in some of the poorest counties in the United States. So you have counties with relatively few resources, and they're just completely overwhelmed with having to clean up meth lab after meth lab. I spoke to a narcotics detective in Southeast Kentucky who said, you know, he wants to be going after drug trafficking organizations, but he's been reduced to a glorified garbage man.
You write about how communities in which this kind of home cooking method of preparing methamphetamine has created just overwhelmed law enforcement and ravaged families. And as a result, there have been efforts to regulate the materials that it's made of, particularly pseudoephedrine. Explain what they wanted, what law enforcement wanted to do in these cases.
They wanted to make pseudoephedrine a prescription drug, which was the status it had nationally until 1976. 25 states have attempted to do this. And really the model for this approach is Oregon, which back in 2006, at the end of a five-year struggle, successfully made pseudoephedrine a prescription drug, and the number of meth labs in the state has fallen over 90%. And so, you know, folks all over the country sort of looked up and took notice. And that's what happened in Kentucky back in 2009. At that time, the state was on track to set a new record for meth labs. They had pulled hundreds of kids out of meth homes, and a lot of what I described as far as the cost to law enforcement was really becoming a burden. And it was also meth labs were spreading east across the state from the farmland of western Kentucky to the rolling hills of Appalachia. It was a question of both the extent geographically and the sheer number of meth labs. And they saw what happened in Oregon, and they said, why don't we try it?
You write about a legislator in Kentucky, Linda Belcher, former school teacher, right, who became convinced that it was important in order to stem the tide of home-cooked meth to make pseudoephedrine harder to get. She introduces legislation, and what happens?
So Linda Belcher starts getting these very concerned calls from citizens saying, you know, don't take my cold and allergy medicine away. The chair of the Health and Welfare Committee and the rest of the committee members are getting tons and tons of calls from constituents saying, vote no on this. And what's odd is that there's been relatively little coverage of the bill in the press. Meanwhile, over at the State Legislative Ethics Committee, which tracks lobbying spending, secretary looks at the filings for the month, and this number jumps out at her, and she sees that over $300,000 has been spent by an organization called the Consumer Healthcare Products Association. And she's sort of never heard of this group before. And in the span of 3 weeks, they've set a new lobbying spending record. So She looks into it, and turns out the Consumer Healthcare Products Association, also known as CHIPA, is the trade association for makers of over-the-counter medicines and dietary supplements, representing companies like Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, and so on. So what it turns out has happened is that they've not only hired one of the state's top lobbyists, but the bulk of that money has been spent on producing robocalls, so these recorded messages that go out to thousands of homes in Kentucky with the industry, the pharmaceutical industry's slant on the issue, saying, you know, the government wants to take your cold and allergy medicine away, press 9 and we'll put you through to your legislator. And so that sort of explains where all these calls came from.
So an instantly generated public response, outrage.
Absolutely. The chair of the Health and Welfare Committee, who'd been in office for well over 30 years, said he'd hardly ever seen anything like it.
And what was the impact of that effort?
It killed the bill. It didn't get out of committee. I spoke to the chair of the committee, and he said his mind was made up and this had no impact on him, although he did say that, you know, this kind of tactic can affect some legislators. Be that as it may, it didn't go anywhere. And meanwhile, the number of meth labs in Kentucky that year went on to set a new record.
Has this happened around the country?
Well, that's what I discovered. It's happened all over the country. Since 2009, 24 states have tried to follow Oregon's lead, and 23 have failed. And this is the playbook of CHIPA, the Pharmaceutical Industry Association. They blanket the state with these robocalls. They hire the top PR and lobbying firms, and they have a remarkable track record. Now, it's important to say that the sort of the degree to which they deploy these resources depends on the state. In my reporting, the sort of the most aggressive and highest spending campaigns have been in the states with the highest number of meth labs, where presumably their chances of losing would be higher, so therefore requiring a greater effort.
Now, yeah. I have to believe that state legislators don't like drug dealers, don't want to see their communities ravaged by meth use, and that, you know, the people who run big companies don't want to help drug dealers and don't want people addicted to meth. What's the industry's case here? What's their argument?
The argument is that it won't work and it'll hurt law-abiding consumers. That prescription legislation is not only ineffective, but it unfairly punishes law-abiding consumers for the actions of the few, of the few who divert this into methamphetamine.
Now, I know that you spoke to the industry representatives. You write about this in your piece. And one of the things they said was that there is an alternative method of trying to control, you know, the unrestricted sale and access of these drugs. That's something called the NPLX, the National Precursor Log Exchange. How does that work?
Basically, what it does is it enforces federal and state law. So the last time the federal government passed any major legislation on meth was the Combat Meth Act of 2005. What it did was limited how much people, how much pseudoephedrine people could buy a month and a year, and it also put the boxes behind the counter. So what NPLEX does, it's basically a database. So when you go to the pharmacy to buy some Claritin D, you have to show ID, and then how much you bought and your identity is logged in this NPLEX system. And law enforcement has access to this database. So it does two things. So if you max out on your monthly allowed limit, it cuts you off for the month or for the year. But it also allows law enforcement to track suspicious patterns or to see, okay, this person's buying, you know, the limit every month. And so it helps. It can help them in their investigations.
So if I have to show an ID, this is everywhere, right, to get
yes.
these products and information is taken. Why hasn't that been effective in dealing with the problem?
A couple of reasons. One is that in states you find fake ID. So people have multiple IDs and so they get around it that way. But the other critical part of this, you know, explosion in the number of meth labs, I mentioned shake and bake. The other thing is this phenomenon known as smurfing. And this is sort of a reaction an adaptation, if you will, to the new limits on how much pseudoephedrine you can buy. What meth cooks will do is they will recruit a bunch of people to buy the maximum amount and buy those boxes off them at black market rates. And it's basically turned NPLEX into Swiss cheese.
Explain that to me. You said they buy it at black market rates?
Right. So let's say I'm a meth cook. I can only get 15 grams a month under federal law. All I need to do is, you know, get a gang of 5 or 10 people to buy, you know, how much they can buy and buy it off them. And typically what I hear is that boxes of pseudoephedrine are going for about $50 a box. And so when you think about where these meth labs are concentrated, some of the poorest parts of America, you know, that's an attractive proposition.
So they go in and pay whatever the shelf price is for the drug and then sell it at a markup to the cooker.
Yeah, tenfold.
Okay. Does that make the meth more expensive to cook at home, and does that restrict, its use?
I don't know the impact on price, but certainly I looked at every state. So now some 25 states have adopted NPLEX. And I basically called the drug enforcement agencies in every state that had NPLEX for at least a year, and the overwhelming majority have seen the number of meth labs go up. So it's not working. Now, the person who runs NPLEX explained to me that the increasing numbers of labs is not evidence of failure because, in his view, you know, NPLEX is allowing law enforcement to actually find more labs.
I see. So it appears there's more labs, they're saying, because, in fact, we have better ways of finding them.
Right.
Okay. I have to ask you, a lot of what many of us know about methamphetamine, or at least our images of it, come from watching Breaking Bad, the AMC show. Do you watch it?
I will embarrassedly admit to only having seen the first 3 episodes. You know, I've spent time in jails with meth cooks who've lost everything. I've spoken to families who saw their loved ones locked up. I've seen meth labs out in the open. And it was more horrifying and depressing to watch this TV show than to actually see it in real life. So I think I definitely want to see it, but I've been kind of a little freaked out by the show.
And why was it more depressing to see on television than what you've seen in real life?
Because I think people are complicated. So, you know, I'm sitting in a cell with you know, Laurel County's best meth cook, and he is full of regret. He misses his children. He wants to get his family back together. He's full of remorse and sort of – it's not unrelenting. You know, his humanity was there to see, you know. He wasn't this ruthless guy. He was an addict who you know, whose life fell apart. And so I think that kind of made it easier to take.
Well, Jonah Engel, it's been interesting. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much.
Jonah Engel's article in the August edition of Mother Jones is called Merchants of Meth, How Big Pharma Keeps the Cooks in Business. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.